Today we're going to be talking a little bit about Hanukkah, but we decided to do something a little different, or I did anyway. And I was going through this about 3-4 weeks ago, and I thought, well, I've taught in depth on Hanukkah the last 3 years, meaning like 2 or 3 weeks. Last year was the first time we actually taped it, you know, the audio portion, and I think that was a couple hours worth. So I thought, well, you know, most of the people are the same faces, so this year what we're going to do is I'm going to give a brief overview of Hanukkah. It's going to be like the fast forward, just catching on the highlights, kind of like what we do in Torah portion, because Torah portion you could really talk about for much longer, but we have to keep it short. So I'm going to give a brief overview, and then we're going to open it up to Midrash. And when we get to that point, I'm going to lay down some Midrash rules, so to speak, and they're guidelines to keep us focused and moving on. So today, count on me talking, you know, 12, 15, 18 minutes. And again, you're going to be tempted to think, gosh, you missed all these different points. Trust me. It's not that I missed them. It's just that in this amount of time, we can't cover everything. So with that in mind, we're going to talk really quickly. Some people have this mindset, or they've been taught, or people have shared with them, that Hanukkah, celebrating it, is wrong. That it's not in the first five books of Moses. And there are people that will tell you, you shouldn't celebrate anything that's not in the first five books of Moses. So I want to set the record straight. We at the House of Scripture do not teach that it's a commanded holiday. We teach that it's something you can do voluntarily if you want to. And the primary reason we do so is Yeshua was in Jerusalem during Hanukkah. Now, we don't know if he participated in whatever they did back then. But you got to remember, in Israel 2,000 years ago, there weren't the types of parties and different festivals and traditions that we do today. Does that make sense? They just had a feast, and they went to the temple, they worshipped, and they honored God for some things that he had done in the past. Purim, they honored the rescue of all of the children of Israel at that time, during Queen Esther and her time. Then Hanukkah becomes the time where the Jewish people basically are saved, again, by the Maccabees. So we don't know if Yeshua did or what he did there, but he was there during that festival. And what we do know is this. All the things they were doing wrong, he let them have it good, didn't he? The religious leaders. Nothing is said about that. So I'm just going to go with the fact that since we're celebrating a feat of God, it's okay, in my opinion, to do it, as long as we don't teach it as law. So John 10:22 is what convinces us that he was there. It says it was now winter, and Yeshua was in Jerusalem at the time of Hanukkah, the feast of dedication. So I take a simplistic mountain approach. We're in the North Georgia Mountains. I'm like, if it was good enough for Yeshua, it's good enough for me. Amen? Amen. Okay. So just don't feel like you have to do it, but I think once you see the joy of it, maybe you'll change your mind and you'll want to do it. The synopsis, and again, I'm going to go quick. Alexander the Great conquered the Persians in 332 BC. And in 10 short years, because he did not have a long life, he died in his early 30s, and I think a lot of people say 32, but I think there are other people that say 33, some say 30, but he died a very young man. But in 10 years, he basically expanded what his father had already conquered. And he expanded the kingdom all the way down south to Ethiopia, east out to India, and then into the Roman era, or the Rome area. Because you got to remember, a lot of Europe was not settled at that time. It was the southern, around the Mediterranean, was what was settled. So he had taken control of that entire area, and let's be honest, that was much of the known world at that time. It was a good portion of the known world. So at some point in time, if you lived in that day and time, you would have been thinking Alexander is the first one-world government, or the first to accomplish that, because it didn't seem like there was any place on earth that he didn't control. And what they tried to do as Greeks, both his father and him, and then after him, is they tried to Hellenize the different people where they took over the lands. Now, for the vast majority of time, it was done with the idea that if we show them the superior Greek lifestyle and how educated we are and how our way of doing things is better, then you'll just naturally want to become Greek. Meaning they didn't force it on their subjects. One of the processes they used to do this is every time they took over an area, they set up a central city and they made it like a modern-day city of Greece. They came in and they put in the gymnasiums, the theaters, they put in a library. They did all these different things that we know from history that allowed people in and around that whole region to see the Greek way of life and thinking everybody's going to have this great epiphany, no pun on words intended, an epiphany that they would want to change over to this lifestyle. So that's kind of what's going on. When Alexander knew he was going to die, he decided to divvy up his kingdom to the four generals. Now, he had no heirs, so it wasn't going to go to his kid because he didn't have one. The four generals received four kingdoms. And those kingdoms are easy to remember. It's called Eat Greece, E-A-T. It's Egypt, Assyria, and Turkey, and then Greece. So those four kingdoms are the four kingdoms of Alexander. This is also, when you look back in the historical, I think it's in the book of Daniel, it talks about the four horns. They're talking about the four kingdoms that came up from Alexander. Alexander passed these down, and Egypt is one of the territories. And Judah, from the time, I believe it was somewhere right around 301, 302 BC, Judah was always part of the Egyptian territory, meaning whoever was the king and the ruler over Egypt kind of controlled Judah. And again, most of the time throughout history, the people that controlled Judah allowed them to carry on in the temple and to do their, you know, to carry out their customs and their laws. They were more interested in the money, the tribute. They were interested in having people for the army if they needed them. That's going to change here in roughly 200 to 190 BC. Actually, it's a little further. I'm sorry. 170 BC comes Antiochus Epiphanes, and he actually took rule a little bit before that, but he was the king of Assyria. Now, he's several generations removed from the generals of Alexander, because we're talking about 120, 130 years. Antiochus Epiphanes gets it in his head that he's going to go and invade Egypt because he's not happy with his kingdom and he wants to expand. So he goes down to Egypt, where Ptolemy is. And when we say these words, Antiochus and Ptolemy, there's like the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh. It could be any number of them. Antiochus the Epiphanes is the one that was responsible for Hanukkah, what we're going to discover today. But Ptolemy, I don't know which number it was. I just know there was like seven or eight of the guys, so it's one of the Ptolemy brothers, right? Or the Ptolemy kids. Somewhere along the way, it's at the same time. So he comes down and he marches into Egypt and he takes over almost all of Egypt. I believe the only holdouts were the southern area where it was poor and then Alexandria. They failed to take Alexandria. But he left Ptolemy in charge just as a puppet king, but now he's controlling this territory. Well, Rome didn't like this too much, but I guess for a couple of years they didn't do anything because two more years later there was some revolt going on. So in 168 BC, Antiochus Epiphanes decides he's going to march back into Egypt, and evidently in his mind he was going to take care of whatever was going on wrong. I don't think history tells us, I could be wrong, exactly what was going wrong, but it wasn't working the way he set it for the puppet kingdom. So he heads back to Rome, before he can reach Egypt, he's intercepted by an envoy from Rome. And they're sent by the Roman Senate. And basically, they drew a line in the sand around him. It said, if you cross this line without giving us an answer, it's going to be war with Rome. And the question to them was, you need to turn back and leave Egypt alone. And at first he was hesitant, and they said, you cross that line without giving us the answer, and we're going to send message to Rome, and it'll be war. So he turned around, and he chose to leave. He knew better than to declare war on Rome. When he's leaving, though, you got to remember who this man is. He's a tyrant of epic proportions, right? We all know this from reading the Maccabees. He's filled with rage and fury that somebody stopped him from doing what he wanted to do in Egypt. So where does he turn his anger? Turns his anger on Jerusalem. On the march back in 168 BC, he invaded Jerusalem, even though there was no uprising, no revolt there. And the history books, well, the books of the Maccabees and the other history books verify it, over 80,000 men, women, and children, all ages, were slaughtered in a 3-day period of time. Another 80,000 were sent away as slaves, taken captive and slaves. This is all 168 BC. Under Antiochus Epiphanes, he changed some of these rules, and we're going to read from the first book of Maccabees. And basically what he decided to do is continue the process of Hellenization of the people, only now it was going to be a requirement of law. And if you did not oblige in any way, it would be the death penalty for you. So, like his predecessors, they tried to Hellenize, but he was going to do it by force, where everybody else just thought logically people will want to do it. But you've got to remember, throughout history, Judah and Israel have been rebellious many, many times over, but they weren't all that quick as an entire group to abandon the Torah and abandon their ways. They did a lot of mixing of holy and unholy at times, but there's very few times in history where the entire country just totally abandoned God. There was always a holdout of certain people who would not go down that route, so to speak. So with that, I wanted to give you a little bit of a picture of what the Hellenization that he was going to require would look like. If you were in this day and time, this is what they would require. They regularly ate swine's flesh, but quite often the swine were sacrificed to idols. They worshipped many gods. The Greek culture had many, many gods. But the sun god was Apollo. Anybody want to guess when his birthday was?
December 25th.
Tomorrow. That's right. They were a society that embraced fornication in general, but they actually incorporated it into much of their pagan god and goddess worship. They invented athletics, the Greeks did. And it's interesting because in the original Olympics, in the original athletic games that were created, the men were competing in the nude. And as if that's not disgusting enough, they had sacrifices to the pagan gods before, during, and throughout the entire games. The original Olympic games were all pagan. All had to do with worshiping gods and goddesses, and all had sacrifices to those gods. That's the foundation of it. Needless to say, every bit of the Greek lifestyle is diametrically opposed to the Torah living lifestyle. It is 180 degrees. It's as far as opposite as you can get. This would include no circumcision for your kids, and we're going to read this coming up. Having any Hebrew writings or scrolls was the death penalty. Any type of worship to the God of Israel, to Jehovah. Keeping the Sabbath, keeping any of the feasts that were, you know, Jewish feasts in this day and time. Because in this day and time, Israel's already cast away. Israel's gone. So this is a Jewish culture right now. It's Judah, Benjamin and Judah, and some Levites. But this is what's going on, and this is where we're going to start reading in 1 Maccabees 1:41. And this is the decree that gets sent out. We're starting in verse 41. It says, "Moreover, King Antiochus wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people, and everyone should leave his own laws. So all the heathen agreed according to the commandment of the king. Yes, and many of the Israelites consented to his religion and sacrificed unto idols and profaned the Sabbath. For the king had sent letters by messengers unto Jerusalem and the cities of Judah that they should follow the strange laws," meaning the Greek laws, "of the land, and forbid burnt offerings and sacrifice and drink offerings in the temple, that they should profane the Sabbath, the festival days, and pollute the sanctuary and the holy people. They should set up altars and pillars and chapels of idols and sacrifice swine's flesh and unclean beasts. That they should also leave their children uncircumcised and make their souls abominable with all manner of uncleanness and profanation. To the goal," this is it. This is written in the Maccabees. It was a letter from the king, and he states what the goal is. "To the goal that they might forget the Torah and the change, and they might change all of their ordinances, and whosoever would not do according to the commandments of the king," he said, "they all should die." Now, skipping down to verse 54, "Now the 15th day of the month of Kislev, in the 145th year," which calculated backwards of the kings is 168 BC, "they set up the abomination of desolation upon the altar, and they built idol altars throughout the cities of Judah on every side, and burnt incense at the doors of their houses and in the streets. And when they had rent in pieces the books of the Torah, which they found, they burnt them with fire. And whosoever was found with any book of the Testament, or of any committed to the Torah, the king's commandment was that they should be put to death. Thus did they by their authority unto the Israelites every month to as many as were found in the cities. Now on the 25th day of the month, they did sacrifice upon the idol altar, which was upon the altar of God, at which time, according to the commandment, they put to death certain women. They had caused their children to be circumcised. And they hanged the infants around the women's necks. And they rifled through their houses and slew them that had circumcised them. Howbeit, many in Israel were fully resolved and confirmed in themselves not to eat any unclean thing. Wherefore, they would rather die that they not be defiled with meats, and that they might not profane the holy covenant. So then they died, and there was very great wrath upon Israel. So the shock of this story is that they knew full well what the outcome would be. There was no mistaking what was going to happen if they violated the king's commands. And quite often, if you read through all of 1st and 2nd Maccabees, you're going to find that the deaths that they underwent were not simple killings. They were most of the time torturous, brutal murders that lasted for hours and were very long and painstaking. But yet they determined in their heart that they did not want to defile the Holy Covenant. And that brings us to something we'll be talking a little bit later in the Midrash about. The Holy Covenant, the book that we follow, is something that is given to us as believers without conditions of what our circumstances are. These people knew that. And they knew that what had come upon them was a byproduct of the whole land being lax and not probably following the covenant is the way they should have. All the times in history when the whole nation, and especially the leadership, was following the covenant properly, they didn't have a problem, did they? Even when people around them had great numbers, God always came through. So the story of the Maccabees comes down to this. God always preserves a remnant. Because we know the end. We know what the prophecies say about the end. And as we were singing some of these songs earlier today, you know, we all think of Zion, you know, and Jerusalem. This is the home of the Jewish people. It's the home of you. It's the home of us Israelites that have been lost in time. It's the home of Ephraim. They are there now, with many of the Jewish people still here in this country, but the Ephraimites will be coming home in the near future. It is our homeland. We need to develop that passion for the homeland, because it's not that we're just supporting our Jewish brothers and sisters. That's wonderful. But it's also our homeland. It's where we come from. It's where we're going back to. Amen?
Amen.
So, God always preserved a remnant. And this ends up being the Maccabee family. Mattathias Maccabee was the father of five boys. And he was the one, the father was the one that stood up and said no to the king's, you know, group when they came around city to city. And he was a leader in the city, and they asked him to defile the covenant so that everybody else would follow suit. And he stood up and said no. And that's the question that we're going to have to talk about today in Midrash. Well, he had five boys. The most famous was Judas, because he became known as the Hammer, Judas Maccabeus. Because when his father died, he took over as the kind of the leader, commander of the army. And let me tell you, when they started out, it wasn't an army. It was a group of people like this that decided to say no and stand up. And before they knew it, it was 300-400 people. But in every single battle, without exception, over the next 3 years, they are outnumbered by ridiculous numbers. I'm not talking 5-1, 6-1. We're talking 100-1. It was numbers that you and I would, it'd be like us going into a street gang fight against 1,000 people. But they knew who they served. And they were willing to lay down their life, but they also believed that God could rescue them and take care of business. And that's what they did. They refused to follow the king's orders, and they fought back. And over the next 3 years, you read in the Maccabees about miraculous battle after miraculous battle. It's an amazing story. And I want you to go home, if you haven't read them, and read these stories over this next week. Read them to your children. Especially pay attention to the prayers that Judas would offer up before he went into battle. Amazing. If you're a real man, you'll have a tear coming out of your eye. It's just an amazing prayer of amazing faith from a guy who had no chance in the natural realm, yet he was willing to go to battle and risk his life. 3 years later, through these miraculous winds, they are able to recapture the Temple Mount. And it states in the Maccabees, when they saw the condition of the temple, they wept, each and every one of them. They had to clean the temple out, and when they brought in somebody who is supposedly an expert in the Torah, they said that they could not cleanse the altar. The altar had to be completely removed and completely rebuilt according to the Torah specifications. They had set up 3 years earlier the statue of Zeus in the temple, and then on the 25th of Kislev, they had sacrificed the pig on the altar. That was what has become to be known as the Abomination of Desolation, the first one. Because we got another one coming in the near future, if you read Matthew, correct? All Israel was rejoicing, and they dedicated the temple, rededicated the temple back to Jehovah. And that was done exactly 3 years to the day on Kislev 25. So Judas Maccabee proclaimed, since he was the leader of the army and basically in charge at this point in time, he proclaimed that the Jewish people should all celebrate Hanukkah at this time of year. And it was for 8 days. Now, I'm going to get into a couple little traditions and then we're going to open up Midrash. I know that was a very brief overview of the temple, but a lot of people say, well, it was 8 days because they didn't get to celebrate tabernacles that year. And I guarantee you, if you go read 20 websites, 4, 5, 6 of them will say that. And I'm going to offer up to you that I think that's not correct. I don't want to say it's ridiculous because it's somebody's idea and opinion, but I would say it's not correct for a couple reasons. Number one, Judas Maccabee proved to be a very faithful and Torah observant individual. And he was a mighty warrior. And they would have known the stories of Jeroboam changing the dates of tabernacles in the fall. And I can't imagine that any Torah observant man of God that had just gone through his 3 years would actually try to turn Hanukkah into the tabernacles. But the second problem is really, if you read the Tanakh carefully, the altar had to be dedicated for 7 days. It wasn't until the 8th day that an actual offering on that altar could be made. That seems to me what the 8 days would be all about, and that's why I think he instituted it. Regardless, it was instituted, and from that time, in 165 BC until today, Jewish people across the globe and Messianic believers in Yeshua HaMashiach have honored and celebrated this time. It's a time where God delivered his people out of sun god worship. If you just want to simplify it to one thing, it was a deliverance from sun god worship. And the odds are that 99% of you in this room at one point in the just not too recent past were delivered yourself from sun god worship. It's a time where we need to be reflecting on the rededication of our hearts, since we know from the New Testament, now that Yeshua has assumed the role as the high priest in heaven, the temple is right here. We are the temple of the living God. That's my view of what Hanukkah is all about, and I believe that the act of remembering this day in history, I really struggle with anybody thinking it's an evil or corrupt thing. Now, I do want to get to some of the traditions that go along with Hanukkah, much like some of the traditions that go along with other holidays. Because the bottom line is, the traditions we need to be careful of. If they come from pagan practices, we need to make sure we don't have anything to do with them, right? That's why we're so upset about, you know, the holiday that's coming up tomorrow. It's filled with, I don't know, 6, 7, 8, 9 different traditions that are deeply, deeply rooted in paganism. The act of wanting to do something that's not in the Bible, do your research, do your homework. If it has origins in pagan worship, as children of God, have nothing to do with it. If it's a holiday like Thanksgiving, if it's a holiday like Hanukkah that's not prescribed in the Torah, just do your double checking and make sure there's no pagan traditions. I really did a lot of research on Thanksgiving when we came out of the church because I wanted to make sure we weren't jumping into something else that was a mess. Only thing I can find, it's a group of people who are praising and thanking God for the provision that he had given them and taking care of them in the new country. So I don't see anything wrong with it. But in today's day and time, listen, anybody here that doesn't have a smartphone, raise your hand. Or a phone. Last night in Marietta, we typed in Google, what is the birthday of the sun god? Google knows it, but most people have no clue. 300 billion people in churches across this country have no idea. Well, not that many, but that was a long time ago. The bottom line is we need to do our research. We have knowledge at our fingertips. We have no excuse. Amen? The two traditions of Hanukkah I want to talk about is the dreidel. Okay, now the dreidel is the spinning top, right? And you get all kinds of stories of where it came from. It came from the Germans. And I'm going to tell you there's nothing wrong with the dreidel. Because let me tell you this. If you play a game of cards with your kid and you're playing Go Fish with your kid, is there anything wrong with that?
No.
Yeah, but in Vegas, they're gambling thousands of dollars using cards. Does that make cards evil? No, it's ridiculous. The dreidel came from the German parlor game where they actually gambled, when they, most likely when they were drinking, because all Germans drink. It's what they do, you know, baby bottle.
They do.
They mix it in. So they had, their letters were NGHS, Nicht, Half, Ganz, and Shtel. Those same letters transliterated in Hebrew, because the Hebrew people, when they adopted this game, kept the same letters. Of course, they put them in Hebrew characters, but it became Nesgadol Hayasham, which means a great miracle happened there. And the second tradition is the miracle of the oil. And this is just a byproduct of well-meaning people trying to help God's reputation out, okay? Let's see. I think God needs a little help. I know he parted the sea, and I know he's done all kinds of miracles and water from a rock, but, you know, we need to come up with a new miracle. And the miracle of Hanukkah is what this small band of men were able to accomplish in the face of impossible odds.
Yes.
What they accomplished is miraculous. But the miracle of the oil is an invented story that came well after Hanukkah. In fact, the earliest recorded writing of it is Tractate 21b of the Shabbat Talmud. Shabbat Tractate 21b of the Talmud. So where it came about, 4, 5, 6, 700 AD, we don't know exactly, but it is not historically, there's no historical writings from before 400 AD that record the miracle of the oil. But in Messianic synagogues and Messianic fellowships everywhere, they teach this as if it's fact. It's just it's a misunderstanding. But I want to get into the questions, because this is where I think we're going to get the meat of having some fun this Hanukkah. And here are the rules for the questions. I know you hate rules, but we're going to start out with, the very first question is going to be, do we have any questions on Hanukkah? Then we're going to go into questions I've written for you guys to kind of midrash about. The rules are this: stay on point, okay? We got to stay on point, because we don't want to turn what should be a wonderful 30 to 40 minutes into 2 hours, okay? Because I know the way you guys get, you guys are really grumpy when you start getting hungry, so okay? But the second thing is, no judging others' opinions, okay? Because when you start doing midrash, little opinion gets involved, right? So no judging other people. Be respectful, even if the opinion doesn't line up exactly with what you think it ought to say. And number three is, we want to let everybody get their turn. So I don't want one person talking 10 times. We need to get the whole group involved, at least the people who want to be involved, right? If you're not comfortable talking, you don't have to. And four, I'm going to shock you, because this is Jasper, Georgia, but women are allowed to speak here, okay? Women are allowed to speak here. I know we had one guy came in here, and after we're done, we're eating, he said, "My goodness, you guys are unusual." I said, "Why is that?" He goes, "You might be the only church in Pickens County that allows a woman to speak in church." And I'm like, "Well, I don't know how to take that," but it was comical, to say the least. So with that overview, I want to open this up with questions. And there's no right or wrong questions. Does anybody have any questions on Hanukkah? Yep.
The nine branch menorah.
Yep.
I'm not sure. I mean, this is something that we've talked about over and over and over and had debate on with other people, but would that not fall into the category of adding and taking away from from Torah, with it being a seven branch in the temple. I've always kind of wondered about that.
It would if you commanded someone they had to do it. See, a lot of the commands that become a problem is when, like the Talmud, for instance, and the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Some of the things they were doing weren't wrong in themselves, right? Washing hands. Most of you had mothers that require you to wash hands when you're coming to dinner table. It's when they turned it into a law and started giving people a hard time for not obeying their laws. You follow me? Mm-hmm. So to me, it's not something you have to have in your home. It's something you can have if you want. We found this one somewhere. Didn't you buy this? Yeah, TJ Maxx on sale. And so we bought it. But we also don't prescribe to a lot of the traditions that maybe some places will do on Hanukkah. Tonight we'll light the candles up, but we don't get all hung up with, you know, which direction and how the shamash is used and saying a prayer and covering the head and, you know, blowing smoke and all that. We don't do that, you know. But there are other places that do that, and they really think in their heart that they're honoring God. And we don't want to, you know, I don't want to diminish that, but we don't feel the need to do the traditions, you know, here. But we have one because we, you know, 3 years ago we found it on sale and got it. But no, that's a good question, though. You know, we're really careful to say there's a lot of traditions. There's nothing wrong with the tradition until you try to tell someone.
If you're listening at home, the Midrash section is very difficult to tape due to the location of the people throughout the sanctuary. So to make it easy, I'm just going to follow up with giving you the questions that we ask the people, and they're questions you can think about yourself, discuss with your family or friends, or just do some research on your own. The first question that we asked was, during Hanukkah, they circumcised their children anyway. They kept Torah scrolls at the risk of death, and they refused to eat pork or unclean animals. The question is, how does this fly in the face of today's attitude that is prevalent throughout the church and the Messianic community that God knows my heart, I shouldn't have to do that? So should we have the same zeal for God's Torah as the mighty men and women of valor back then in the days of the Maccabees and the Hanukkah story? Question number two. What if we had a natural disaster and there was no food for weeks at a time in the area that you live in? All of a sudden, the Red Cross shows up with 100,000 ham sandwiches. Question is, what would you do? And as a follow-up to that question number two, I wanted to just briefly read 2 Maccabees 6, 18 and 19. Eleazar, one of the principal scribes, who was an aged man and of well-favored countenance, was constrained to open his mouth and to eat swine's flesh. But he, choosing rather to die gloriously than to live stained with such an abomination, spit it forth and came of his own accord to the torment awaiting him. So he knew he would be tortured and then killed. His friends were part of the enforcement team, and they told him they would secretly give him clean food if he would just eat it pretending that it was pork. His answer is that he would rather die than lead others astray with what appeared to be him violating the Torah willingly and leading others to their destruction. That leads us to question number three. The Hebrew word Hanukkah means dedication or rededication. The temple was defiled by the Greeks and had to be cleansed and rededicated, and this is why we have the holiday of Hanukkah. You and I were defiled by our own sin, and at times we continue to defile ourselves with sin. So the question is, should we look at this time of year and reflect on the dedication of our hearts and our bodies to Messiah Yeshua? Can we use Hanukkah to remember where God rescued us from and how he has also delivered us from some form of pagan worship at one time in our lives or another? Question number four. Throughout history, Hanukkah has never looked like the holiday we see today. Even in Israel today, it looks nothing like the American Hanukkah. In America, For many families, it has become the Jewish alternative to Christmas, so to speak. In America, you will see many Jewish and Messianic families doing some or most of the following. They will have a Hanukkah bush and lights on their home. They will decorate much like Christmas, but possibly change out the colors to just blue and white or silver and blue, versus the traditional red and green you find at Christmas. Still, many families bring in greenery, evergreen trees, or branches from the trees into their home for their decoration. And finally, many of them will call these decorations winter decorations versus holiday or Christmas decorations. This type of thing was never done in history and almost never done in Israel even today. So the question is, in light of all the recent studies that we have done at the House of Scriptures regarding the commands for us to be holy and separate the holy from the unholy, and specifically the command to not learn the way of the heathens and then worship me, God, in that way, how can we avoid the trap of making Hanukkah just a kosher Christmas? And five, God rescued the Jewish people in the Maccabee time and during Esther's time. Purim and Hanukkah are two holidays that came from these great periods of God's miraculous intervention and the delivery of his children out of sun god worship. How do these two events differ, and what can we learn from them? As a follow-up to question number five, I would like to note that during Esther's time, the devil tried to physically wipe out the Jewish people. He used Haman. During the Maccabees' time, the Greeks tried to annihilate the people spiritually by destroying all vestige of Torah living. They had no desire to kill the Jewish people, they just had a desire to break them and change them into Greeks. And by doing so, remove all vestige of Jewish history, Jewish ways of thinking, and Jewish life from their midst. This concludes our Hanukkah Midrash. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you will tune in next week for another message from the House of Scriptures. God bless, and have a great day.